Today's lecture is on gaining competitive advantage with a decision support system. Vendors like to tell potential customers that if you buy our product, you will gain a competitive advantage. It's a common claim that information technology vendors make for their software. As an IT professional, you need to be skeptical of those claims. So in today's lecture and in chapter 2 in the book, we'll try to go over some of the ways that decision support can create competitive advantage and how we measure competitive advantage and even what it means. I want to assert that computerized decision support systems can improve the profitability of the company where managers use them. If we build decision support systems that help us with customer relationships, they can help us gain and retain customers. And one of the most common benefits we see from computerized decision support is reducing the decision cycle time. That means we speed up how fast we make decisions. We reduce the time from when we initiate a decision process till we complete the decision process. That's the decision cycle time, and that's one of the most common benefits of computerized decision support. The topic of technology and innovation is an important one. In the late 1960s, Gordon Moore, who was at Intel, came up with something called Moore's Law. And Moore's Law said that about every 18 months, the capacity on an integrated circuit chip doubles. The first processor chips that we had could only have about 4,096 circuits on the chip. Today, we have very large capacity integrated circuit chips for our CPUs, our computer processing units. That's why the speed of processing keeps increasing, and it seems almost exponential, and the cost keeps falling. But if you look over the last 30 years, our microprocessors have gotten faster and less expensive. And that's led to the computer revolution that lets us do things like have devices on our belt that are a phone, that are a personal device for computing, that let us surf the web, that let us buy a portable computer for $600 because of the improvements in our central processing units and the capabilities that we can put on a silicon chip. We still have too many isolated decision support capabilities, so we're building more integrated capabilities using the web browser as a front end, and we go to a portal. Information technology advances in wireless and networking and in touch screen displays and mobile computing are creating new capabilities for decision support. Part of what's exciting about information technology is there's so much change. There's so much change, and we need to be smart enough to decide what to adopt and when. If we build model-driven decision support systems, there's pretty good evidence that that can improve our operations, our business operations, whether it's providing service for forecasting or inventory management, or whatever at the operations level, scheduling of machines or people. There's pretty good evidence. But a lot of those systems are old and they need to be rebuilt. They're legacy systems. So we're going to do a lot of that over the next 10 to 15 years. And now we can build systems where we connect organizations. We call those inter-organizational systems. So we can involve our partners in our supply chain. A company like Walmart can involve Procter & Gamble and give Procter & Gamble access to their databases remotely so that they can better forecast how much toothpaste you're going to buy and make sure that toothpaste in adequate quantities is in the warehouse that Walmart maintains, for example, down in Mount Pleasant, so that they can get toothpaste onto those shelves in a timely way so that people have toothpaste or mouthwash or potato chips or whatever they want to consume when they go into the store. And that's a massive logistics network that only functions because of information technology. Every Walmart store has a satellite dish on the top so they can transmit information at high speeds to their warehouses. They did that before we had good land-based wiring. They invested in information technology to reduce the cost of providing goods and services, but especially goods, to people in their stores. The World Wide Web is strategically important. It's only been around a little over 12 years. 12 years. Now that's half the more than half the life of you, but for somebody like me, an old guy, you know, that doesn't seem very long. It's like I blinked my eye, and in 1995 the web was this embryonic commercial medium, and today, I mean, we're all using the web. Over 1 billion users of the World Wide Web on this planet. Now out of 6 billion, that's not that many. 1/6 of the population. But lots of business users, lots of recreation use, and in the developed countries we have extensive use of the World Wide Web. We take it for granted today. Media are converging. With high-speed networks, we're going to have movies on demand. You won't have to have somebody mail you a DVD and then you return it. You'll download the DVD and you'll see it in high def and you'll have a copy for a day. Other media are converging too. Newspapers, audio. You see it with YouTube. You see it with the fact we can have a WAV file on the DSSresources.com website where you can listen to this lecture. That's convergence. It changes the way we do business, but it also means we need more decision support because there's so much information and the decisions take on greater magnitude. Network technology is mission critical. It's quite possible that in the developed world there will be wireless almost anywhere. It'll be better than what you have with your phone connections now. It'll be high-speed wireless, and it'll be cheap so that we can all be connected to the web and to our Facebook applications or LinkedIn applications or Second Life all the time. Or Google Earth. You'll be able to be connected into Google Earth and you can look ahead when you're in your car or you're walking down the street and see what's there. So decision support's going to be personal. Computing's going to be personal. That's what Ottolini is telling us at Intel. Computing is becoming personal. It's dedicated to you and your needs, and you take it with you all the time. That's where we're at in 2008. And interactive video over IP. You're going to have a video device that's the size of your watch, and you're going to be able to look at it, and you're going to be able to call your mom. Okay, and you're going to be there'll be a camera there, and you'll be able to look at your mom on your video device, and she'll be able to look at you. And you'll have multi-way video conferencing that you carry around too, so you can video conference with a couple people. The images might get small, but they're going to be there. Now, this is not wild speculation; it's all possible right now. Okay, we've got video over IP. It works. We've got small handheld devices that you can use for video. It's the cost that has to come down. E-commerce. December 2007 was the biggest year for electronic commerce sales in history. More products were sold on the web in 2007 than ever before in the holiday season. And this was at a time of approaching recession where retail sales in stores was down and retail sales store sales on the internet was up. We have new models in business cooperation. Like I say, we have more sharing of data. We have affinity cards where people can be recognized when they go into a store and they get discounts. So we have big databases that we share among partners. So you get a You Promise account, and everything you buy goes into a big computer, and you don't do anything. You just get credit for it when you buy it, and you get a little rebate. Handheld computing. The iPhone showed us what's possible. A simple browser that you can manipulate with your finger. And a high-resolution display, and you can actually read it, and yet carry it around and use it as a phone, as a music device, and as a web browser. And the price keeps falling. It started out with a good memory, $499. Within a month, they lowered the price by $100. In a couple of years, you'll be able to get that as your free phone when you renew your cellular plan, or a better one. And very large databases. Since the early 1990s, we've had terabyte-sized databases. The first company that really had big databases was Walmart, because they wanted to keep 11 months of store data from their cash registers. By 1996, they had 15 terabyte data warehouse. Today, Walmart has hundreds of terabytes, and AT&T will have a 500 terabyte warehouse. There's speculation that the National Security Administration has over a 1 petabyte data warehouse for national security data. Data storage is increasingly cheap, increasingly fast. EMC, the big database vendor, now they have a large multi-terabyte database that's all flash. So it's very fast. A flash-based, large-scale database. It used to be that having a hard drive that was 1 gigabyte was expensive. I've got a 1 gigabyte memory stick in my phone here. And I've got 200 music items, 200 songs on my phone on a tiny memory stick that's smaller than my thumbnail that went into my phone. And that's a gigabyte of memory. Of course, it still costs too much for my phone. I think it costs $29.95, but that's because I had to buy it from Verizon. Okay. But it's there. So databases are going to get huge. If you look at the new Leopard operating system from Apple, and you've seen the commercials, one thing they're touting now is backup. They'll back up your desktop from an hour ago, from 8 hours ago, 16 hours ago, 24 hours ago, and you can go back to the way things were, and it'll do it automatically. It's fast, so that you don't notice any performance decrease. And memory storage is so cheap that you can afford to keep those backups and not give up the ability to store video and music. I've got hard drives where I use less than 10% of the storage on those hard drives. There's more storage at a lower price than I need. So the vendors are coming up with neat things so that if you manage to do something really bad, you can go back to where you were. You can have that kind of active data backup. The first decision support system that was built for Westinghouse in 1966, the raster graphics display cost over $100,000. It was running on a computer that had 48K of random access memory, and the data was stored on a drum storage device, and it could only hold about a megabyte of storage. That was 40 years ago. That whole system, $200,000, and it ran on a modem between the display screen and the computer at 1,200 baud. 1,200. That's very slow. 1,200. And all the commands were typed in on a command line. We didn't have any mice. Okay, they did have a light pen. But it cost $100,000 to get a light pen so that you could change things on the display easily, so you didn't have to do everything command line. We've made enormous strides. You guys are going to be working for the next 40 years, at least, probably 45. Just think how the world is going to be different when you retire. The population of the world is going to be at least 2.5 billion people more. And think of what's going to happen to technology during your career. You're going to have so many new things to learn, but there's so many possibilities to use information technology to improve decision making and the way we do business and to make our operations more efficient. It's an exciting prospect if you take the challenge. Well, decision support systems can help companies compete. Now, a competitive advantage means that you do something better than your competitors, and that lets you be more profitable. You get to charge a little more, your contribution margin is a little higher, so that your firm is going to be more profitable than other firms in the industry. That's what a competitive advantage is all about. It means you're going to make more money on the same volume of sales. Now, why is that important for private profit-making firms? It's important because shareholders want better returns. Look at Intel. Intel makes a lot of money. 28% is their return on sales. But the biggest reason their stock price fell from $27 a share to $19 is because people were disappointed that their sales weren't higher and that they just met their earnings projection. Profit is important to share price. Information technology can improve profitability. Decision support systems can improve decision making and can help firms be more profitable and more competitive. But not every decision support system is going to improve profitability in the competitive position of the firm. And yet they're still valuable. We still need to build them just to remain competitive. Here on slide number 5, I give you 5 criteria. The first thing is that computerized decision support has to be significant in the organization. It has to create a significant capability. That means we've got to have multiple users and that the decision being made has to have an impact on the performance of the organization. Either because we make it so often or so many people make it. So it may be that we have a decision support system at Walmart to help with customer returns so that we make better decisions about whether to accept a returned product and to check for fraud to make sure that it's not somebody who's been stealing from us. That can impact profitability if we create a decision support system to help our customer return desk people and a database of people who are known to have returned a lot of products over the last 60 days so we can spot abusers. That kind of a tool can improve profitability. And it can be proprietary, hard for our competitors to duplicate. But it has to be a major significance trait. It has to be unique and proprietary. If everybody can buy the capability from a vendor, it will not give us competitive advantage. If a vendor comes in and he says, buy this off-the-shelf package, it only takes a week to install, or you can get it up and running in 2 weeks. Your competitor can too. All they have to do is go buy that same capability. Now, does that mean you shouldn't buy it? No. If your competitor bought it, you may need to buy it just to stay competitive. But it's the issue that you have to have it to stay competitive. You're not buying it to get competitive advantage. Do you see the difference? I know I'm walking around. I hope the sound is good. We'll see. It needs to be sustainable. It takes a while to get a payback on your investment in information technology. I say 3 years there. Actually, the world's moving a little faster. So we may be able to get our payback faster than 3 years on some of these technologies. And imitation occurs faster. If we let people, competitors, know about our innovations with IT and decision support, they can actually duplicate or imitate it faster today than ever before. And they're likely to. If they see us gaining advantage and they can figure out how we're doing it, they're going to work to imitate it. We saw that with package tracking. When business and personal customers wanted to be able to track their packages with express delivery services, immediately when the first tracking service was put up as a web-based service where you could type in your package number and see where it was, before long everybody had it. And you didn't have 2 years to regain your advantage and get new customers. It was quickly imitated. And that was a decision support capability. Have any of you tracked a package using the web? It's very nice to be able to track packages and see where it is and when it's going to arrive, and it helps you make decisions. A big investment in database, but it was quickly imitated. No long-lasting advantage. But now you have to have that if you want to sell package delivery services. Even the U.S. Postal Service has it, and we know how slow the U.S. Postal Service can be. Well, how does information technology and decision support alter competition? The first thing is it may change the structure of the industry. We may get rid of the middleman. Some people have said that we'll be able to go online and we'll be able to design our car and we'll be able to watch it being produced on the assembly line in Detroit at General Motors, and it will, 2 hours after it comes off the assembly line, it'll go on a car carrier and it'll show up at our house the next day. That means that you won't have a lot of cars sitting in inventory on dealer lots. Now, if GM's smart, they may make you come to the dealer to design your custom car and you pick it up at the dealer rather than having to deliver it through to everybody's house, and that way they can get a down payment and they can do the financing and all those kinds of things. But it's well within our capabilities right now to produce cars to demand if Detroit automakers want to do that and to have those delivered to automakers. That would change the industry structure. It would change the way auto companies do financing of dealer inventories. It would change the supply chain. So that's the idea of using decision support to alter industry structures. Supporting cost or differentiation strategies. Cost strategies mean we do things to reduce our costs. Take that example with the auto industry. If we produce to demand and we produce the car that a person designs, that is, they pick the options in a dealer showroom with a salesperson, look at what that does to our cost structure. Less inventory, both end user inventory in the auto dealers, but also parts inventory. And look at what it does to differentiation. It means that the car you get is tailored to your needs. So you'll either have a stripped down model to help you with being more frugal, or you'll add on lots of extras and we'll get all the additional revenue because you did that. And now with graphics technologies, you'll actually be able to see that car as you put the extras on, and you'll be able to do a 3D view of it. You'll be able to go inside and look at it before it's built, and then you'll be able to see, maybe even with a video camera, its production, going down the production line if we want to do that. And it shouldn't take very long to produce that kind of a custom product. But that will revolutionize that industry, and it will involve the customer in making decisions about the product that they're going to have and use. It may increase control. We can do a better job of tracking the loans that get made by the banks, so we don't have as many defaults on consumer loans or new home loans. We can do a better job of tracking the performance of our salespeople and who they contact. And decision support systems can provide new capabilities we've never thought of. Our imagination is the limit. Decision support systems can be strategic information systems, but they don't have to be. Every decision support capability does not have strategic implications. In your book, you'll see a strategic impact grid, and it's a simple 2x2 matrix. We have to realize that some IT applications have a high strategic impact if we build them, and that in some organizations, the existing IT already has a high strategic impact. But organizations differ in their use of IT and in the systems that they might build. The best organizations to work in for decision support are ones where IT already has a high strategic impact and where the new systems we can design will have a high strategic impact. So that's the strategic quadrant in the top right of the grid in slide number 8. In the factory quadrant, we need IT, but decision support won't be a priority, and we can talk until we are tired, and we're not going to persuade managers that IT is anything more than an operations tool to get work done. Okay, it's part of how we deliver product, and that's all that managers see. Until managers realize that IT can have a strategic impact, we can't promote decision support there. Where it already appears that managers accept the impact of information technology on consequences, decision support capabilities can be critical to future success. In organizations that see information technology in a support role, and that's what we see at a place like a university, decision support systems are unlikely to provide a competitive advantage. If you look here at the University of Northern Iowa, we don't have any strategic decision support systems. You'll see decision support systems in food services. You'll see them in the motor pool. You may see some simple executive information systems in some universities that track things like enrollments or other kinds of things related to recruiting new students. In selective universities, you may see decision support systems that help identify and select students for admissions. But universities tend not to do a lot with decision support, even on the financial side where they should, because most of what happens is in course enrollment, in the maintenance of things like grades, in providing IT services in classrooms, and universities have not quite figured out how to use information technology strategically. Even when they use tools like the internet to deliver classes, it's not very strategic. It's just another delivery mechanism. It's not part of a strategy. And then some organizations are struggling. They don't use IT very well. They know that information technology can help in the future. There's some hope there. But it's always hard to work in an organization that's struggling financially and is having difficulty implementing IT. You have to be especially patient and creative in that environment. Well, let's look at slide 11, where we go over some different ways that decision support systems can provide a competitive advantage. We already saw that it can alter industry structures, it can provide cost advantages, help differentiate what we offer. But we have to realize that there are other innovations. And part of what we have to do is not only rebuild legacy systems, we have to build innovative decision support capabilities for organizations. We keep pushing the boundaries. We do more decision automation, so we can automate more decisions, but we can use the computer for more routinized decisions in organizations than ever before, and we certainly can do a lot more special studies using computer support. There's a lot we can do with inter-organizational decision support systems to provide linkages to customers or suppliers, letting customers build their own product with graphic visual tools, letting suppliers have access to our customer purchases or our databases. We can increase efficiency in the time it takes to make decisions. We can eliminate some staff, and that's always controversial. Or we can reduce activities or let the computer do some of the activities that we had people do. We can gain that cost advantage that we talked about. And with decision support, we may be able to create new products and especially new services. And that's part of a differentiation initiative. Communications-driven decision support can remove time and location barriers. Part of the reason I'm interested in Second Life is because that virtual world can create a working world for companies where time and location barriers fall down, especially location barriers. You can have a distributed corporation and you can easily meet with people who work in an office in Hong Kong or Western Europe. We still have time zone issues, but we don't have the barriers to collaboration that we get with video technologies, and we don't have the problems of impersonal contact that we get with the telephone. We get not only voice, but we get interaction. We get experience. We can share experiences in a virtual world, which makes the decision support more powerful than anything we've ever had. We can target customers better with the web. We can have focused websites. We can have focused tools. We can use facts more in our decision making. And the last point on slide 12 is we can decrease cycle time. The cycle time for a decision is from the time we recognize the need to make a decision, so we initiate a decision cycle, to the time when we've made a choice and we're ready to implement that decision. So we can contract the decision cycle. That means a given manager can go through more cycles in a day, make more decisions, or we can be more responsive to customer needs. In Chapter 3, you'll see an example from IBM Credit, where IBM Credit was able to change and re-engineer their processes, bring in better technology, and reduce the decision cycle time from weeks to hours. And we need magnitudes of improvement like that if we're going to gain competitive advantage. Well, the bad thing about lecturing is we don't get much interaction. How many of you have had a chance to read the strategic decision support examples in Chapter 2? Frito-Lay, L.L. Bean, Lockheed Georgia, Mrs. Fields Cookies, and Walmart. How many of you have read those examples? A few. Okay. Well, I want to go over them briefly, but you should read those examples. You should know what kind of decision support it is, if it's data-driven or model-driven or communications-driven. You should see what the dominant component is that we use for decision support. You should look at who the targeted users are in each of those examples. And you should look at the enabling technology. These are all old examples. Part of the reason for that is firms need to be careful about disclosing information on decision support innovation. You can't have a competitive advantage if all your competitors know about your innovative decision support. So as the book says, some of these companies have replaced the capabilities that you read about. Others have continued to innovate. And some may still have legacy applications that no longer are strategic, but it serves the function. Company needs to continually invest in a strategic decision support system if they want to maintain any advantage. So it's not like you build it once and it's going to forever give you a competitive advantage. That's just not the way the world is. So the chapter lays out five classic examples. Some are better researched and understood than others. Frito-Lay is a part of PepsiCo. The case is from, I believe, 1989. When Frito-Lay decided to provide handheld computers to their route salespeople. So over almost 20 years ago now, they were working on the implementation of that. The idea is that salespeople should have a decision-making role and they should push products that were in the warehouse and the company wanted to move. They should change the product mix that they put out in the grocery stores to better move inventory out of the warehouses. But also, the marketing people and the production people at corporate headquarters in Texas wanted better information from the route salespeople so they could make better decisions on what to produce and how much, and they could see what was selling and what products needed to be introduced and what needed to be improved. Well, this was a big success. It was written up in a Harvard case. The good thing for Frito-Lay is they have the dominant market share in snack foods, and they're not really challenged. So they could brag about how they've done that, and it certainly improved their sales through the grocery store channel. They sell through other channels. But they still have very innovative technology for their route salespeople, and they've tried to keep up with what's going on. So Frito-Lay, data-driven decision support, providing information to salespeople about quantities in the warehouse and providing data at the end of the day. Now it's almost real time back to a large data warehouse. That's what they're doing in 2008. L.L. Bean, a large catalog company. They've got a retail store, but they also sell a lot over the phone. And they were one of the early innovators in call centers. The system that is described here is a model-driven decision support system that they can use every quarter to reconfigure their call system, heavily based on management science models, to try to reduce the number of lines that sit empty and to minimize the number of operators, and yet take into account how long you have to wait to get through to an operator. Call centers are still important, even though people order over the web. I know my wife orders from L.L. Bean. It's still nice to be able to get their catalog, to call up, or to go on the web, see what's available, and then call somebody in a call center and have them put the information into the information system. So this was a tool, a model-driven decision support capability to help the managers of the call center figure out how to configure that call center. So they were concerned about how many telephone lines they should have for incoming traffic, how many agents should be working, how to schedule those agents to work in the call center. They wanted to deal with the capacity of the queue. If you have thousands of people calling every day, you don't want to alienate your customers. So it becomes important to think about the call center and how you configure it. So that's more of a model-driven optimization problem. Lockheed, Georgia, the late 1970s, we were innovating with executive support. The idea was that middle and senior managers needed status information on big projects. Lockheed, Georgia produces large aircraft, and they do a lot of defense contract work. So they wanted to improve communications, and they wanted to provide managers with information on the status of their products, projects, and reduce costs. So they created an executive information system on proprietary hardware. They created basically web pages, but these were static pages that IT people would update once a month or when needed, and there were hundreds of them. And these were status reports, graphs, and charts. They were not dynamically created. They had, back in the 70s, if you wanted pages like that that people could access on a local area network, information technology people had to do that. So we had pretty skilled people who were basically creating reports for managers that they could access. Now the Lockheed Georgia system also had email early on using the IBM PROF system and some other early technologies for intra-company email. So they tried to provide other types of communication support as well as some data-driven support. They wanted more timely and accurate information. Well, you all know what happens to technology. It gets obsolete. So by the late 1980s, their system was very obsolete, and they had to decide if they wanted to go with a proprietary system and highly specialized hardware, or they wanted to move to a development environment and then rebuild the system using some code that was going to be available to their competitors. They decided to go with more of a development platform. They used, they looked at hardware and software. They decided they wanted to go to IBM PCs. They wanted to go to standard Ethernet technologies. So they purchased software from a company called ComShare, which was in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time. It was a product called Commander EIS, Commander Executive Information Systems. It was a development environment, highly graphical, and ComShare let the people at Lockheed, Georgia suggest changes to the basic development environment to better imitate what they had been doing with their software. This case was written up in a number of different publications in the 1980s, a very famous case. The fate of ComShare. Well, the fate of ComShare is a warning to all of us. ComShare eventually, by the mid-1990s, discontinued the Commander EIS product. Lockheed, Georgia had done what everybody says. They had negotiated to have the source code, but the product got increasingly obsolete. Eventually, ComShare was acquired and is no longer an independent company, so that basically there was no support. I do not know today what happened to the Lockheed Georgia EIS. I do know that in the early 1990s, they had a major disaster with their executive information system. They had a product failure. A project to build a plane was overweight, and the executive information system did not flag that to them. They had not been looking at that as a key performance metric, the weight of the plane. And it was an enormous financial loss to the company. And they blamed it on the fact that their executive information system did not give them warning that the project was producing a plane that was too heavy to fly and that didn't meet the military specification. I would say don't blame it on the IT. Blame it on the people who designed the system and the metrics they produced, and on the managers who didn't realize they should be tracking how heavy the plane was in the project. But that really caused a lot of concern that maybe executive information systems didn't meet all the needs that managers thought they would. So clearly, if you don't monitor the right variables, the executive information system isn't going to help you make good decisions. And we all know that, don't we? If you don't look at the right metrics, you're not going to make very good decisions. So this is a case of early innovation, trying to move to a more commercial product, and then having some failures with their information reporting. Mrs. Fields Cookies. Randy Fields, Stanford MBA, I think. His wife, Debbie, made good chocolate chip cookies. They started a cookie business with franchises. He developed software in the early 1980s on a Tandy TRS-80 with, I think, 64 kilobytes of RAM and a small little 5 1/4 inch floppy drive and a modem, 2400 baud modem. They put that out in each franchise store. They had over 200 stores with that system that his company built. And the system was supposed to help the managers of the stores decide how many cookies to bake at different times of the day, help with hiring employees. This was in the early 1980s. I've talked on the phone with Randy and studied this in detail. It was written up as a Harvard Business Review case. It was supposed to provide better control, so they'd report financial information, and help in better management decision making. Each store supposedly could be run the way Debbie Fields ran the original store. Well, this worked until the late 1980s, and it allowed for rapid expansion. Mrs. Fields was acquired. Randy kept the software business. He had both a model-driven and a knowledge-driven system and a transaction processing system. So it was a multiple subsystem, and it was all a disk operating system running off of these floppies. So this was really, you had to switch in different floppy disks for different applications. I mean, this was in the dark ages. Many of you weren't even born in 1982 when this system went into effect. Okay? Worked pretty well. By the late 1980s, they needed a new system. The company was acquired. It's been bought and acquired a couple of times. Randy kept the company. The company's called Park City Group. They still, there's still software in Mrs. Field stores, and they make a number of other products that are decision support related. Randy is a big believer in decision automation. He thinks that the software should tell the managers, bake 2 dozen chocolate chip cookies and 4 dozen sugar cookies at 8 a.m. and hire this person and don't hire this person. So he's got a fresh produce manager now to help decide what produce to stock in the grocery store and when to mark the price down, and a number of products. They're still out in Park City, Utah. I think they're privately held now, but Randy was trying to take the company public. Interesting case study and example, and you can read Randy's interview in the Thought Leader interviews at dssresources.com. The last one is Walmart. I don't want to spend too much on this, but Walmart's been an innovator in decision support, and they continue to be an innovator with radio frequency identifiers, and they have started experiments to require suppliers to have RFID tags. The big innovation in the 1990s was with forecasting and replenishment. We abbreviate that FAR, and a system called Retail Link, so that a big supplier like Procter & Gamble could get access to their databases and see how much inventory was being sold in the stores and how much was on hand in their warehouses. Walmart has over 3,000 stores. It's a complex distribution system, complex inventory management system. Basically, they told Procter & Gamble, you make sure that we have adequate supply in our stores so that we can have product on the shelves of everything you sell us. We don't want to ever run out. And we won't pay you until we sell the product. So it's to your advantage to minimize the inventory but ensure we don't run out. And that's what collaborative forecasting and replenishment is all about, is reducing the amount of product in the supply chain but ensuring that a retailer like Walmart always has adequate supply. The idea of radio frequency identifiers is that ultimately every product that's sold in a store like Walmart and every case lot that they get in will have a radio frequency identifier. So when the product comes into the warehouse, we'll have readers that read what product comes in, and when it goes out on the shelves, we'll be able to do continuous instantaneous inventory. We'll know what's there. There won't be any shoplifting, because if a product is taken out of the store, we will know immediately that that product has gone out and it hasn't been paid for. We won't need cashiers. In a perfect world, you'll go through a reader and you'll insert your credit card. You'll walk through with your cart and the reader will know what you bought and it will charge your credit card, and there'll be a slip that comes out at the end that shows what you bought. But the computers will know what you bought, and the warehouse will know instantaneously what you bought, and Procter & Gamble will know instantaneously what you bought, and the trucks will replenish the inventory as needed from those warehouses. That will be a radical change in retailing. Yes?
I had this issue brought up in an earlier class today. What happens once the RFID goes through the scanner and you leave the store? Can they still track it, or does it just stop?
There are two types of RFID, passive and active. And for active, where it's sending out a signal, it's usually short range rather than long range. So you would have to be within maybe 10 feet or 50 feet. You can set how the active RFID works. So once you leave the store, there won't be any monitors anymore. But if somebody had the technology and they came by your house and they had Walmart's product codes, they might be able to know what products you had in your house. But my guess is that there will be some mechanism that you can buy that would disable RFID once you leave a store. Within the store it wouldn't work, but outside the store you'd be able to do that, or at least privatize it. But there are those issues that we need to think about. Clearly for decision support, the more information we can get about what people buy and what they use, the better it is for the manufacturers. From a privacy standpoint, people don't really want somebody driving by their house and being able to take a computer device and know exactly everything they have in their house. You know, how many boxes of cereal they have and whatever else has an RFID tag. So there are issues we need to work out. And there are going to be labor union issues too, and people who are displaced from jobs as cashiers and whatever that we need to think about. But RFID is coming, and lots of things will be RFID enabled. But it's a good question, and something as IT people we need to think about. Well, how do we find these new opportunities and do IS planning? I want to finish up the lecture here. The first thing is we need to do systematic search. And we need to link IT planning and decision support planning to business strategic planning. We need to do decision support research and development. We need to have projects going on with things like RFID or handheld decision support or using an iPhone for decision support. We need to experiment with new technologies and new capabilities. We need to look at our technology infrastructure and see what's possible now and what we need to add. We need to consult with managers and other IT folks and go to workshops and conventions. Most managers and IT folks need to learn more about decision support systems. Hopefully they'll visit some of the web resources that I put together. Not all projects are created equal. The ones that we want to try to build are ones of moderate risk, but the ones that are most likely to give us high payoff are the high risk ones. Those are large scope and low structure. And low structure means that we have ambiguous objectives. There are many risks associated with decision support. To get advantage, we have to take risks. We just have to know what risks we can afford. The major risk, in addition to the technology risk, is the people who are going to have to use the decision support system. If we build it and it's not used, we have an enormous cost. That's why one of the guidelines that I gave you in Chapter 1 is people have to feel they need the decision support capability and they have to want to use it. So we need to be concerned about who the potential users are and make sure we market the decision support capability to them. If people resist the system, it fails. The chapter goes over a lot of additional benefits besides competitive advantage, improving personal efficiency, improving decision quality, improving communication, training and learning. You can actually learn how to make the decision better by using some decision support capabilities. And then we've already talked about increasing organizational control. That evokes ideas of 1984 and George Orwell's vision of Big Brother. But companies need to monitor performance and they need control over operations. So that won't go away. And companies are willing to spend money for improved performance monitoring and organizational control. There's a long laundry list of other benefits. You can see six of them on slide number 26. I leave it to you to look at it. The key thing is to keep in mind some decision support opportunities are better than others. If you're asked about the benefits of decision support systems, the first thing to do is tell people that it depends on the purpose of the system. Let's see what the proposed system will do. Then we can see what the intended benefits are. So let's look at the purpose of the decision support capability. Well, the last part of the chapter deals with some excuses for not building and using decision support systems. Companies and managers have had some bad experiences with both information technology and decision support. 10 or 15 years ago, maybe we could argue that managers had insufficient training. Today, that should be less of a barrier. most managers should have some familiarity with using personal computers and information technology. It doesn't lower the status of a manager. It's not good enough anymore to just say that, oh, I don't use computers, or managers shouldn't use computers. That's for staff people. We can't let managers have that excuse in 2008. The others, the one we have to be responsible for as IT professionals, is poorly designed decision support systems. We need to make sure they're well designed and that they don't create too much of an information load. These are often very expensive systems. They're large, complex, and risky. We can gain advantage from building them, but we don't just build decision support systems to gain competitive advantage. They can provide other benefits. So some very useful decision support systems do not provide significant competitive advantage, and that's okay. The very last slide deals with some review questions. There are also some review questions on the website. I encourage you to look at these. There will not be a quiz on Thursday, but probably next Tuesday we will go over the material in Chapter 3 and then have a quiz over Chapters 2 and 3, short quiz. We didn't get done quite as quickly as I thought. We'll see how long we need on Thursday for the introduction to VBA. But I appreciate your patience. I know I lectured and I said a lot. It should be covered in the book. And now, because of Shannon and Mark, you can also go back and listen. I hope I didn't wander around too much and that the quality is good. Shannon may have to tie me down up here. And you can do more of what Joe did. You can interrupt on the topic and bring things up. Or I guess it was, I'm sorry, it was Joe was very quiet. But you can talk. I'll see you all on Thursday. Thank you.
You'll have to set it up.